A Wednesday evening Lenten sermon preached by Reverend Richard A. Ram at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan on February 20, 2002 in the series The Grace to Let Go, entitled When One Loved is Dying. The texts for the sermon are Luke 2, verses 33 through 36, and Mark 3, verses 19 through 35. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Our Lenten theme is the grace to let go. The grace to let go in a variety of human circumstances. The grace to let go in a number of human situations, relationships. It is a grace because it is a gift to be able to let go. The sign of our Lenten theme is the hand in contrast to the fist. When the fist is clenched, there's tension. And the clenched fist is a defensive instrument, the sign of potential conflict. And the clenched fist is a sign of the way some of us live our lives, tight, full of tension. In contrast to that, I'm suggesting that the grace of letting go can be symbolized by the open hand, not just a limp rag, but a hand that's open, a sign of grace, a sign of openness and receptivity. And so tonight, the grace to let go in our intimate human relationships as we look at Mary and her son. The grace to let go in those human relationships which are so critically important to us and so precious to us that we often, rather than having the grace to let go, grasp them to us and squeeze the life out of them. It is a tension to live in loving relationship. And if we take a model from the God of the biblical story, then it would seem that the model is to love, to invest, and to set free. Now that's a miracle, to love, and to invest, and to set free. For the very human tendency is to do the other, to love fiercely, and to invest, and then to possess, and to attempt to control, because that gift is so precious that we would possess it and we would control it, lest we lose that which has become the center of our lives. Whenever our lives get out of our own center and are centered in another, there is bound to be a problem at one time or another. To love, to invest, and to set free, that's a grace. And that's what I want us to think about for a bit this evening. And to do that, we can do no better than to look at the relationship between Mary and Jesus. I read three different passages. I could have added more, But the story of Jesus and his mother is rather fascinating in the Gospels, especially in a day like ours when there is a claim that the families are falling apart. And I think indeed we do have elements of crisis in society at large. And certainly, nothing that I would say this evening which should in any way denigrate the importance and the beauty of the family. The family in which we are born and which we are nurtured, and then hopefully in which we are launched and set free. But nonetheless, there is a lot of talk in our day about the falling apart of the family and the stress on the family in its nuclear form, in its traditional form, which, frankly, the story of Jesus and his mother just doesn't support. Probably one of the worst things I could do on a Mother's Day, for example, would be to preach about Jesus and his mother. I think there have been many mothers who have been a little bit chagrined at Jesus when the story is told. And there should be those who are advocating a traditional family as the only possibility. There should also be some questions and some wonder on their part. For the story of Jesus and his mother just doesn't bear it out. Luke is a great writer, and he foreshadows some of this in that scene in the temple when they bring Jesus at 8 days for his circumcision, and old Simeon gathers him in his arms and says, "Now, Lord, let your servant depart in peace," and so forth. And then he says to Mary, "And a sword will pierce your heart." That's often the case, isn't it? To love and invest and set free is to risk disappointment. And to love deeply is to be vulnerable to swords piercing our hearts. There's no other way. I always tell Nancy that I'm going to die before her because I don't want to deal with her Lynn if she would go first. Those relationships can be so fierce and so deep and so loyal and so beautiful. And so it's not surprising that we have trouble with this. But once again, let's get back to the text. Mary, there's a sword will pierce your heart. If we would have gone on in that chapter, remember the story of Jesus at 12 years of age going to the temple. Rather strange story where the family goes on pilgrimage to Jerusalem and they go a day's journey back home and, well, guess what? Jesus isn't there. Well, I don't think that story was just simply the fact that a young boy got lost, even though it may be strange to figure out how that could happen. But even given if it did happen, the point of the story was that Jesus was, there's already there, again, some foreshadowing on the part of Luke. This boy is going to need some space, mother, because this one at 12 years of age, in Luke's story, says, "I must be about my father's business." And then, of course, early in John's gospel, I didn't read this, but the wedding of Canaan, you remember, when they ran out of wine. And Jesus' mother, as a good Jewish mother, comes to him and says, "Take care of it." And he says, "What is that to you and me, mother?" Which, in effect, translated would be, "Mother, bug off. Stifle yourself, mother." And he does eventually do what his mother wants him to do, but after creating his own space and his own independence of action. And then perhaps the most telling story is in Mark's gospel, where Jesus had been in the full flower of his Galilean ministry And the opposition was beginning to build, and they were saying of him, he's possessed. And so he encounters them with the fact that if he's casting out demons in the name of demons, then the kingdom of darkness is divided against itself, and so forth and so on. So he counters them, but his friends were saying, he is beside himself. The word literally eccentric, he is out of center, he's out of kilter. And what is worse for a parent than to see a child making a fool of themselves out there? For there's that natural love that wants to guard a child against that kind of exposure. And then if we're honest, what really gets us as parents is that we're embarrassed by those miserable kids. Because what they are and what they do reflects back on us. And so Mary gets his brothers and they go off to where he is, and the place is jammed, they can't get in, and so they send a note in. And the note is handed to Jesus, your brothers are here. He says, my mother? Who's my mother? Those who do the will of God. Those are my mother and my brother and my sister. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Mary. It's kind of tough. Nancy doesn't, it's the only time she doesn't like Jesus is when I talk this way. And then, of course, at the cross. And this is sort of to get Jesus back into the good graces of mothers everywhere. A kind of a sentimental moment, as it were, a little domestic scene in the midst of the horror of crucifixion. Jesus sees his mother and says, mother, behold your son, pointing to John, the beloved disciple. And to John, behold your mother. And mothers everywhere breathe a sigh of relief, because in the end, he redeems himself. And he does the noble and right thing. And he commends his mother to the care of another. And yet, when we read John's gospel, we know that it is so highly symbolic. And there is not a scene in there that just happens to be in there. John is painting a picture. And what's happening at the cross is not just simply a little domestic scene of filial devotion. What John is really saying is that through Jesus' death and resurrection, what is coming into being is a new community. A community that transcends bloodlines. A community that transcends the natural formation of things. A community of mutuality and love and respect. A community that transcends that which is given and natural. He's talking, in a word, about the church. And the church, if it is what it should be, is but a sign of a world in community. Jesus and Mary, in the rather interesting little, these are almost little appendages on the larger story. But what is painted for us is a relationship which is natural and good, which can become possessive and controlling, resulting in dysfunction. And who of us, honestly, in our families, doesn't have a measure of dysfunction here or there? Because it is not easy to live in authentic human relationships marked by love and investment and setting free, is it? None of us do it perfectly. And really only a few of us do it really well. And most of us stumble and stammer and need often to be forgiven and to seek grace again and again. Because you see, there's no easy blueprint. And there's no simple formula that fits all. The grace to let go, to live with an open hand in the most intimate relationships of our life, that is a grace, and that is a gift. But the wonderful thing, the wonderful possibility that comes out of this is the fact that human community, ideally, is something tighter and more wonderful than anything that nature itself can produce. A community of spirit, of heart, of mutuality, transcending that which is given. We don't choose our parents. We can't choose our family. All of that is given. And it is important. And it can be so very wonderful. And we ought to strengthen it and encourage it in every way we can. But then also know there's something more and something even better. And that is the possibility of human community. The possibility of open-handedness and open-heartedness to another. And that bonding and that binding must be the ultimate picture of community according to the intention of God. If God is love, and love is the essence of community. You know, this has implications. It's remarkable to me that in Western Michigan, which is in some senses a kind of Bible belt, a sort of conservative religious ghetto, it's remarkable to me that we have the most difficult time coming to realize that intimate human relationships don't come in ready-made, preformed patterns, one set fitting all. And I'm thinking now, for example, of the whole question of same-sex relationships. Dear God, what a problem we're having with that. And why should we? If in the creative promiscuity of God, there are creatures on the whole spectrum of human sexuality, and if love is that which transcends all, then in faithful covenant love, why should that be a threat to any other human arrangement or family? And I'm thinking now of Grand Valley University, right, our neighbors, when there are a number of universities throughout the state who have come to recognize that and to give equal rights. And we can't do it in Western Michigan. And why can't we do it in Western Michigan? Because we're such a conservative Christian community. A Christian community. Grand Haven High School, right now, there's advocacy for a gay, straight alliance. It's just a group, a support group, a share group. And there's real resistance to that. And why should there be? If we read the Gospels, if we read the kind of torturous relationship between Jesus and his mother, if it is true that at the cross Jesus was pointing to the future and to the ultimate, a community of mutuality and love. You see, love transcends all. Living this way, this need not be a problem. Living this way, and there's tension, and there's anguish, and there's worry, and there's fear. We need the grace of the open hand that says, my. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that amazing? Well, isn't that wonderful? Well, I never would have dreamed it. And the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, wasn't it something? Nation after nation, the proud participants from around the world carrying their flag, their faces. Have you watched the faces at the games? Faces of all kinds. So alive. So vital. So beautiful. Have you watched from all around the world the impossible feats of trained bodies and alert minds? The Olympic Games, it's a beautiful symbol of the possibility for human community. And the only way it can happen is when we have the grace to love, to invest, and to set free. And there is nothing in all the world to compare to the love that's returned by one that has been set free.